In capitalist countries, it generally requires 20 or 30 years for annual chemical fibers production to rise from 100,000 tons to 500,000 tons. China, on the other hand, claims the Ministry of Light Industry, China began importing nylon production techniques from the West only in the early 1960s, but it has achieved these annual production rates in just 10 years, thanks, it is claimed, to the properly critical attitude towards things foreign, which Zhou Enlai inculcated. Zhou Enlai is fast becoming the sort of deceased patron saint of China's borrowing from the West. And he laid down this criticize and change, use, criticize, change, and create four-step strategy, and they say it works brilliantly. Okay, well, what this debate over China's annual nylon production shows is that the borrowing of Western industrial techniques can be defended in China in the winter of 1976-77 only if this borrowing gets tangible results equal to, or indeed superior to, the results of the history of those industrial techniques in the West. If they don't, then the people who are responsible for bringing them in get into trouble. In other words, cultural borrowing from abroad still has a sort of fragile legitimacy in Chinese politics, a legitimacy which can be called into question during almost any political struggle. Does any other major country in the world make foreign scientific influences such objects of political and ideological passion in 1977? It's hard to say. Foreign influences and models are permanently rooted in China, however. The social egalitarians, who seem to be anti-foreign, say that they want to construct a new Chinese society whose ideal social relations will be like those not just of Yan'an, but of the Paris Commune of 1871. Well, you could say that the Paris Commune of 1871 is no more innately Chinese than is the production of nylons. In other words, different inspirations from Western civilization are now helping to shape the entire political debate in China. Furthermore, the economic maximizers, who are charged by the Gang of Four with being a traitorous foreign affairs clique, they answer that the Gang of Four themselves were secretly under the spell of foreign decadence. Zhang Qing herself, the Chinese people were recently told, was a great admirer of the American novel Gone with the Wind. For those of you who don't appreciate the linguistic economy of the Chinese language, the whole majestic title Gone with the Wind, when you translate it into Chinese, shrinks to just one relatively humdrum Chinese word, piao, the whirlwind. But Gone with the Wind, or piao, it's a reactionary novel, say the Hua Guofeng group, it's a reactionary novel which romanticizes slaveholding. The heroine of the novel, the Chinese people are being told, incarnates an extremist, egotistical, male-conquering individualism and will use any method to gain her own ends. Actually, I thought the man in the story got back at her, but this is the Chinese interpretation. The Gang of Four, by admiring her, have found themselves, quote, a sister in a foreign country, unquote. So each side of the debate accuses the other side of too great a fondness for foreigners. To make the link between Zhang Qing and Gone with the Wind as firm as possible, the Hua Guofeng government has employed the services of a foreign literature research specialist at the Chinese Sciences Academy. This foreign literature research specialist at the Chinese Sciences Academy, Liu Mingzhou, he has recently written articles for Chinese newspapers in which he has expounded the whole plot of Gone with the Wind to Chinese newspaper readers with almost as much gingerly care as if it were an abstruse text in nuclear physics. In other words, it's a measure of the continuing delicacy or awkwardness of China's relationship with Western culture that the Chinese government has to rely upon an exalted science academy expert to discuss a rather mediocre popular novel with which most of the non-Chinese world is all too familiar. Well, some of the things I may have said about the Chinese policy struggle may have made it sound fabulously exotic or even a bit pathos-laden. I should state very quickly, therefore, especially in connection with China's relationship with the West, that much of the Chinese debate also deals in a very sophisticated way with moral issues which are important to every person on this planet, but they're moral issues which have usually received far more serious attention in Chinese civilization than they have in our own. I can't help thinking, for example, that in the old China, even warlords, to say nothing of philosophers, but even warlords were accustomed to debating the thorny question of the relationship between virtue and talent. Was it better to have a ruler who was stronger in virtue than in talent, or vice versa? The Chinese usually argued the former. You needed a virtuous ruler, talent was secondary. What was the best way of combining talent with virtue so that virtue remained preeminent? Virtue, wrote a harassed Chinese general 100 years ago, virtue is like the source of all water. Talent is simply like the wave motions of the water, unquote. In other words, a very secondary sort of thing. Western civilization has never acquired, I would say, the same habit of debating this issue as prominently or as comprehensively. You don't have to look at Richard Nixon and so on. Western civilization has never acquired the habit of debating this issue as prominently or as comprehensively as has the Chinese one. So it's not very surprising that China should harbor more hostility to rule by experts, whether these experts have proven themselves to be virtuous or not, than any other country. The Chinese are not going to accept rule by experts without asking what are the moral qualities of these people who have the expertise. China is perhaps the one country in the world that is most likely to demand that experts prove their virtue as well as their talent. How you define virtue in 1977 is another issue, but this is a basic Chinese theme, and it is an important one. Is regionalism involved in the current Chinese struggle? All I can tell you, on the basis of the few newspapers that we receive at the university from China, all I can tell you is that no question seems more difficult to answer than the question of how important a role regional interests play in any given Chinese political process. Suppose the shoe was on the other foot. Suppose you were a Chinese Canada watcher living in Peking and trying, on the basis of reading a few Ottawa newspapers and perhaps Maclean's magazine, trying to uncover the mysteries of Canadian politics thousands of miles away. You would learn, if you read the Ottawa newspapers and Maclean's, you would learn that all the provincial premiers of Canada were talking glibly and eagerly about the decentralization of the country's political structure. And you'd read that the provincial premiers had recently attended a meeting in Ottawa where they had demanded and had received more favorable provincial revenue-sharing agreements with Canada's national government. Unless, however, as a Chinese Canada watcher, unless you were lucky enough to get your hands also on the December 16, 1976 issue of the Edmonton Journal, you would not know that no sooner had Premier Peter Lougheed of Alberta returned to his province with these national-provincial revenue-sharing agreements than he refused to make any revenue-sharing agreements with Alberta municipalities. These municipalities had naturally assumed, in view of all his talk about decentralization, that Mr. Lougheed would sympathize with their need for a fixed percentage of provincial revenues instead of a few grants with strings attached. They were wrong. In other words, if you were lucky enough to put all the pieces together on a basis of many different newspapers, you might get a picture of the real truth, that many Canadian provincial premiers don't want real decentralization at all. They want a kind of, shall we say, provincial absolutism, lots of powers for the provincial politicians. But these ambitions are carefully disguised by terminology, and the same is true in China, and that's the problem we face. The Chinese press has told us that during the hegemony of the Gang of Four in the city of Shanghai, areas around Shanghai refused to supply the city with such elementary necessities as coal and cast iron. To get goods to Shanghai moving again, a campaign has been launched among Chinese workers to get these Chinese workers to believe that, quote, the whole country is a single chessboard. The whole country is a single chessboard, a very Chinese way of saying that regions are economically interdependent. The fact that such a campaign is necessary is eloquent enough. My main reason for hardly talking at all about Vietnam this evening is that I've given so many other lectures about Vietnamese developments to Vancouver audiences in the past year. I was afraid that some of you might not appreciate my repetitiveness. But my giving short shrift to Vietnam is ironic because it matches international realities. I think it is safe, if sad, to say that whereas Canada may be more interested in China than China is interested in Canada, the reverse is probably true for Canada and Vietnam. Hanoi is much more interested in Ottawa than Ottawa is interested in Hanoi. Last October, 1976, the undersecretary of the Vietnamese Foreign Affairs Ministry, a man named Huang Luong, led a special Vietnamese delegation to Canada, which spent 5 days in Ottawa, Montreal, and Toronto. Talking with everybody from the Secretary of State for External Affairs to officials of Petro-Canada and the Canadian International Development Agency. This Vietnamese mission to Canada received front page coverage in Hanoi newspapers, which we get at the university. It did not, needless to say, receive much front page coverage in Canadian newspapers. On the other hand, Canadian newspapers would have a disruption in China on the front page. The Chinese put the October 14 demonstration against wage and price controls in Canada. It was reported in China, but in the back pages. One CBC news commentator, I believe, did analyze the Vietnamese mission to Canada in October, last October, by saying very knowledgeably that Hanoi regarded Canada merely as a surrogate, I think was the word he used, for the United States, as a kind of secondary go-between country through which Vietnam could gain access to American terminology. This sort of analysis is provided to us by our own broadcasting system. It obviously belittles Canada's international position. It has the additional disadvantage of being totally false. Hanoi sees Canada as being, in some curious ways, a country like Vietnam. That is, a country important enough to play a constructive world part without ever having the capacity to become a superpower, and that automatically makes us more lovable in a way. In August of 1976, Hanoi published a map of the world, this is last summer, which divided the planet politically into three types of countries. The capitalist imperialist countries, the communist countries, and countries whose chief significance was that they had recently achieved their independence through decolonization. In this Vietnamese map of the world of last August, the capitalist imperialist countries included the USA and all of Western Europe, including Sweden, Spain, even Ireland. The communist countries, of course, included Vietnam and China and the USSR and so on. The countries which belong to category number three, the newly independent decolonized countries, included India, Burma, Indonesia, most of Latin America and Africa, and Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. All this might come as a big surprise to Mel Hertig or Mel Watkins, but I think you can see how tediously wrong the CBC assumption of Hanoi's views of Canada inevitably being one of Canada's a sort of second-rate copy or surrogate of the USA. I think you can see how tediously wrong these views are, based on no information or genuine knowledge of the Vietnamese at all. The only problem that Hanoi has that I can talk about at the moment is that there are two Vietnams. These two Vietnams are not the North and the South, as they were before 1975. They are, rather, the two Vietnamese economic civilizations of, on the one hand, densely populated, irrigated lowlands, and, on the other hand, sparsely populated, poorly irrigated highlands and mountainous regions. Vietnam currently has a population of 50 million people. If this population continues to grow at its 1976 rate, it will be 100 million by the end of the century. Hanoi would like to cut the present rate of Vietnamese population growth in half, which would mean only 75 million Vietnamese by 2000 AD. What's so striking about this population of 50 million people is the unevenness of its distribution. In northern Vietnam, a lowlands province like Taibing has a population density of 1,095 people per square kilometer, and that is a lot. Highlands or mountain region provinces not very far away from the lowlands have an average population density of 51 people per square kilometer. So as you can see, there are two Vietnams in terms of human settlement and economic patterns. Between now and 1980, Hanoi plans to move some 10 million people, one-fifth of the present population of Vietnam, from the overcrowded northern and central delta regions into the northern highlands and, above all, into the south. This is a massive, I suppose, a somewhat draconian enterprise for which the Vietnamese army must become one of the principal agencies. The army is in existence in Vietnam today. Its task is now agricultural development. Between 1976 and 1980, the army is to clear for agriculture some 500,000 hectares of land. The army is supposed to convert all these newly cleared lands into what the Vietnamese call army state farms, and the army is supposed to build houses and schools and hospitals for the people who will soon be living on these state farms. The peasants who are being moved to these new economic zones are given 50 piastres at the outset with which to buy blankets and mosquito netting. When they arrive in the new uplands economic zones, or in the south, as construction workers, they'll receive the regular Vietnamese rations of 21 or 24 kilograms of rice per month, and will be allowed to buy per month 800 grams of meat, 2 kilograms of bean curds, 500 grams of sugar, 10 grams of noodles, and one piece of soap per month. They will be entitled to 10 or 12 days of holidays after 12 successive months of work. That is third world poverty with a vengeance. It also, however, on the whole, represents better work conditions than Vietnamese peasants engaged in corvée work for the French or for pre-communist Saigon governments used to enjoy. So you have to be careful what conclusions you draw. To sum up everything, for reasons of necessity, Vietnam has fallen into the hands of economic maximizers. There is little Chinese-style debate over revolutionary strategies about bringing inequality right now before you expand the economy. Hanoi has joined the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. 15 Japanese companies per month send delegations to Hanoi. They have economic treaties with Sweden, Denmark, and other countries. They badly want Canadian participation. the East Germans are rebuilding the city of Ving, which was totally bombed, and so on. I suppose I could vindicate my own profession in concluding by saying that this is what an historian might expect. Historically, China was always the home of vast debates over ultimate social and economic goals and arrangements. China, I think, had the richest tradition of utopian philosophical speculation in the world. This is not to say that anything that's being discussed there now is utopian, but they do have a tradition of great speculativeness. Vietnam, a smaller country, continually beset by outside pressures, never had the time for such debates. And this remains true today. Stop there.
When Dr. Woodside was lecturing at Harvard, the Vietnamese conflict, both the one in China and the one in the United States, was at its height. Therefore, he ran into a good deal of conflict, not surprisingly, during his lectures. So he's not afraid to hear questions which may not agree with him. So whether you're egalitarians or economic maximizers, he said he's quite willing to hear your questions.
Comment on the tension or lack of tension between Mao, the believer in permanent revolution, and Zhou Enlai, the maximizer. I've never quite understood how they go along.
Oh, I see. Okay. The question was, could I discuss the relationship between Mao Zedong, who believed in permanent revolution, and Zhou Enlai, who was an economic maximizer? It's a tough question to talk about the relationship between Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai. It's like no other. Mao is... Everybody is going to appeal to Mao now in China. Everybody, no matter what their position, will say this is what Mao believed in. And people who believe in the most orthodox sort of modernization, economic modernization, and they use that term, modernization, they'll appeal to Mao, and the people who are very hostile to that will appeal to Mao too. And to some extent, I think you could get away with that because Mao was sort of a middle of the roader in some ways between... there were people whom you would say believed in permanent revolution and so on even more than he did. And so that I'm not sure... The question of how much Mao and Zhou disagreed with each other is... that's a very tough one because... That's a really tough question, and I'm not sure we know all that well. But Mao Zedong, in a way, you can appeal to him for almost anything. He had different phases, and he was, within the Chinese political context at various times, a sort of middle of the roader, in the sense that there were people who wanted to go even farther with permanent revolution than Mao did. What the relationship was between Mao and Zhou between 1970 and the death of both of them in 1976, I don't know. It's a tough question. Yeah.
Is it true, as it appears to outsiders, that Zhou Enlai had really been running the country for quite a long time, was using Mao as a figurehead?
The question is, was Zhou Enlai running the country using Mao as a figurehead? Once again, these are things we don't know. How ill Mao was, people who saw Mao until very recently, just before he died, felt that he was lucid. He was physically decrepit, of course, but he behaved in his Socratic manner, asking big questions and so on. And I suppose the Chinese answer to that right now would be that they were a good team, and in a funny way they were. Zhou Enlai was an administrator and ran the country on a day-to-day basis as prime minister. And Mao Zedong, sometimes he was pushed aside or pushed back when he didn't want to be, but other times he sort of held himself back and dealt with broad policy directions and that sort of thing, so that they did complement each other. Now, there may have been conflict, but it's hard for us to get at it. So I hope that nobody and people in the back want to ask questions. Wave your hand vigorously. I'm short-sighted.
Can you say a word about how a historian copes with the lack of source material on China?
Can I say a word about how the historian copes with the lack of source material about China? It's awfully tough. You have to read the newspapers extremely carefully, the newspapers that we get. There are some historians who believe in going to Hong Kong and interviewing refugees, but the trouble with that is you get the refugees have reasons of their own for telling you what they want to tell you. If they're refugees, they're discontented. Their discontents may be broadly based ones, or they may be just personal idiosyncrasies. There are cases of refugees in Hong Kong who told their interviewers that they had been judges in provincial courts, and it turned out later that they'd served tea in the provincial yamen, but they weren't judges. Then at the height of the Cultural Revolution in China, Chinese in Macau noticed that all these American political scientists had come to Hong Kong to work on the Red Guards, reading Red Guard pamphlets, and so these Chinese got together in Macau and got their own little printing press out and started writing Red Guard pamphlets, and they were brought taken across to Hong Kong, and for a while that was great. It's very tough. What's interesting is that the Vietnamese are far more forthcoming with hard information. I read the Chinese newspapers, and then I read the Hanoi newspapers, which we also get, and the Hanoi newspapers will tell you very candidly and in great detail what's going on economically and so on, and the Chinese newspapers are so much more general that it's very frustrating. There are complaints columns in Hanoi newspapers, a little like the column in the Vancouver Sun. You write in because you haven't received your social, a check or a product you bought or something, and the newspaper tries to put it right. Well, if you read the Hanoi newspaper, people write in complaining about various things, and then the official who's responsible for fixing it up has to explain what he's doing. And this, once again, you have to be careful to figure out whether this is typical or not. One complaints column in a Hanoi newspaper recently is a public security chief from Quang Ninh province up on the border, and he said, the district government has given village so-and-so, and he named the village, an economic plan to plant 700 acres of rice in this coming year, but they have abandoned 100 acres of their 700-acre quota. And he said the reason for this is that many people in the village work outside the village, engaging in illegal peddling in the countryside, and so they aren't working in the fields. And he said the comrades, the party members of the Village People's Committee, have been warned about this and told to get their village functioning again, but they have done nothing about it. And he said, so now we'll have to bring in the Women's Association and the Ho Chi Minh Labor Youth League and the public security apparatus and so on to make the village perform economically. So Vietnam, of course, is a smaller country, but you get a tremendous amount of documentation from Vietnam at the moment that we don't get from China and have not got from China since the late 1950s. So I suppose the answer to your question is beware of anybody who lectures on China, because... yes.
You mentioned in your talk several times, or intimated, possible differences between the egalitarians and the economic maximists in relation to the West. Mm-hmm. And as one country, you mentioned Russia as part of the West. It's probably been obvious to many people in the room for some time that China's taken up a fairly new policy toward countries like the United States, out of a fear of Russia. Mm-hmm. What differences do you see between the maximists and the egalitarians in relation to Russia?
The question is, how does the Soviet Union figure in the debate in China, and what, in general, what would the various Chinese attitudes be towards the Soviet Union? My guess is that both sides are profoundly skeptical of the Soviet Union. So what does this mean for the future? I think the Gang of Four is probably, the social egalitarians are more skeptical of the Soviet Union because they regard it as the number one bad example that they don't want China to imitate. and they've lost out. So does that mean that the people who are in power now might be more friendly to the Soviet model, so to speak? Possibly, but I think you have to disentangle the interstate relations question, China's diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union and the United States, for that matter, from the question of where China gets revolutionary ideas from, apart from China itself, which is where most of them come from. I think that you could see a warming of diplomatic relations between China and the USSR, because it seems to me that the thing that annoys, there are many things that annoy the Chinese about both the Americans and the Russians, but if you look at the territorial dispute aspect, it's Taiwan on the one hand versus the Central Asian border questions on the other. It seems to me that any leadership in Peking can choose between the two and decide which one it's going to emphasize or de-emphasize at any given period. In other words, it's conceivable that a new Chinese government could say, well, Taiwan means more to us. Solving the Taiwan issue means more to us than handling this border dispute in Central Asia, so we'll become friendlier with the Russians and less friendly with the Americans. It seems to me that that is... there would be some historians who would say no, on the grounds that all Chinese governments throughout time have always been more concerned with Central Asia than with the South Coast, but I don't think that applies in the 20th century. Okay, so it's possible that the diplomatic relations might improve between Peking and Moscow, but I don't think we will ever see a return to what I regard as the most extraordinary period in Chinese history in the 20th century, the period between 1949 and 1957, when Chinese newspapers said, we defer to the superior Soviet experience. They said that. They kowtowed the Russian experience publicly. That's very unusual. And China was filled with Soviet advisors of all kinds who gave lectures, sometimes very condescending and tactless lectures, in 1955, which reprints in detail the lecture which a Soviet educational specialist gave to the East China Pedagogical College in 1955. And the Soviet educator got up and said, comrade, your work is sloppy, you Chinese are very disorganized, you should follow the model of General Suvorov, a Russian general of 18th century, I think, and late 18th century, and all this sort of, there's a tremendous reaction to this, and so I don't, the social egalitarians and the economic maximizers, to use my two rather crummy, but I can't think of any better labels, they have a great deal in common, too. They both appeal to yen-en, as I explained. They're both committed to to material growth. I don't think the social egalitarians want a static society. They're both suspicious of pulling in Western and Soviet technology uncritically. They're both suspicious of foreign influences. Jiang Qing and Gone with the Wind, the Gang of Four are accused of importing a German ideology into China. That's Marxism for you, you know, the German ideology. Well, but on the other hand, the Gang of Four accused their opponents of being too foreign, of being a foreign affairs clique. So there are a lot of things in common. So I would say interstate relations might change, but I don't think you'll see a return to China of 1949-57.
Lady, way up the top there.
Yeah, could I, since I've been discriminating against the top, yes.
You said that
no, up the lady up the top.
Could you please say something about the relationship there are any between Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos?
Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, okay. Could I please say something about relations between Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos? The relations among these three countries appear to be friendly at the moment, especially between Vietnam and Laos. And there's a great deal of material on Laos in Hanoi newspapers. In fact, probably the best source that we have on what is going on in Laos appears in Vietnamese newspapers. So there seems to be a friendly relationship between Vietnam and Laos. The Vietnamese relationship with Cambodia will always be problematic. It seems to be friendly at the moment. But the great difference between Vietnamese relations with Laos and Vietnamese relations with Cambodia is that historically the Cambodians have disliked the Vietnamese intensely because the Vietnamese were constantly invading Cambodia, as were the Thais on the other side. Cambodia, somebody said, is a sort of Poland of Southeast Asia, in the sense it was constantly being invaded by the Thais and by the Vietnamese. So the Vietnamese revolutionaries in dealing with Cambodian revolutionaries have interests in common, but they have to live down a horrendous historical background. Prince Supanuvong of Laos is married to a Vietnamese woman. One can't imagine a Cambodian revolutionary, even a nominal one, being married to a Vietnamese woman. The psychology of the relations between the Vietnamese and the Cambodians on the one hand and the Lao and the Vietnamese on the other is very different. In the 20th century, all these three countries were in French Indochina, what was called French Indochina. And the French supplied a unifying framework, and this did give them things in common. The Vietnamese revolutionaries have always believed that any outside powers who tried to dominate Vietnam would also try to do so through Cambodia and Laos. And so they saw the Second Indochina War as precisely that, an Indochina war, not a Vietnamese war. The Battle of Dien Bien Phu, border pacification prefecture, was fought to defend Laos. The French were fighting an Indochina war too. So there's a unifying framework which the colonialists supplied, and now the common fact of three revolutionary governments supplies. But beneath that, the psychological undercurrents are very different depending on which country you're talking about. And okay, who's
up right at the top there?
Professor, you remarked about Canada lectures on Peking. And I seem to feel a message coming in from a satellite. It's Confucius and Ho Chi Minh would like to know if philosophy and truth and poetry are found in Canadian newspapers, and if so, which?
Well, the question, I'm sure you all heard it. You didn't hear it? Okay. The question is, do you find poetry and philosophy in Canadian newspapers, and if so, which? I must say I don't know of any, but I... let me...
despite your disparagement of refugee statements, surely there can be no doubt about the colonial exploitation by the Chinese of the people of Tibet. Would you care to comment how this issue is being discussed in the present day Chinese hierarchy?
The question was, despite my disparagement of refugee statements, there's no doubt that the Chinese are engaged in a... hegemonial, did you say? A colonial relationship with Tibet. And would I care to give any, would I care to talk about the current Chinese leadership discussing the Tibet question? The second part of your question I can't answer. I don't know what they're saying about Tibet at the moment. As far as the first part is concerned, the Chinese answer, to give it to you first before we make our own value judgments, the Chinese answer would be, first of all, that they are improving Tibetan life, that it was a reactionary feudal theocracy with horrendous mortality rates and so on, and they've brought modern medicine and all that sort of thing in and got rid of a decadent feudal state which had led to ghastly poverty and so on. The second part of their answer would be that if they didn't control Tibet, the Russians would, because they see Tibet as having been a part of the multi-ethnic Qing Empire since the 18th century. Tibet was seized by the Qianlong Emperor in the 18th century, and so as a part of the multi-ethnic Qing Empire before the age of nationalism, into the 19th century when the British and the Russians began to compete for influence in Tibet. So the Chinese see themselves as being the heirs, I guess, of this multi-ethnic, ancient multi-ethnic empire, although they're operating in an age of nationalism. And they went in there to make sure the Russians didn't go in and to restore their claims to be the heirs of the Qing Empire. Is this colonialism? Depends on your point of view. I think it's plausible, certainly, to accuse them of colonialism, yes. I think so. But that would be their answer.
Closer to the Soviet Union and becoming more frosty to China for some little time. And I think that perhaps their policies have changed somewhat. I noticed that today they say there's no class struggle in socialist societies, but in 1972, Lehtoe was saying that there was.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure whether the maximization policies is really a continuity throughout.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you, do you focus on any particular thing that would start this estrangement from China? I can't quite explain.
The Vietnamese estrangement. The question was, the question has to do with Sino-Vietnamese relations. That is to say, the Vietnamese seem to be moving closer to sort of Russian approach to economic development and so on, and seem to be moving farther away from the Chinese. And can I point to any one thing that would stimulate this? Soviet technicians are everywhere in Vietnam and so on. Well, the Chinese have been there too. I mean, they built paper factories in Hanoi and that sort of thing. There's no question that they are. I would accept the main. What's the explanation of this? It's first of all, China is the hereditary enemy of Vietnam. Is this a factor today? It seems to be, yes, because of the tremendous passion for things historical in Vietnam. In 1963, the Party Central Committee in Hanoi, December of 1963, publicly criticized unidentified members of the Party Central in Vietnam for, as they put it, as far as I can remember literally what they said in Vietnamese, not having washed themselves clean of a mentality of servitude which was a residue of having been ruled for 1,000 years by a foreign country. Now, Vietnam has only been ruled by one foreign country for 1,000 years. That was China until the 10th century AD. This is a reference in Hanoi in 1963 to a Chinese rule over Vietnam, which ended in the 10th century AD. Just to give you an idea of the way history plays its role in the debates in Vietnam and in China. So therefore, on the basis of that, one would have to say that if you look as if you're being too predisposed to follow Chinese advice or Chinese models, this can be prejudicial in Vietnam. Apart from that, I suppose one has to come down and say that the Vietnamese genuinely believe that the Soviet Union, it seems at the moment, to be more stable than China, and they don't want instability given the fragility of their circumstances. I think that's part of it. On the other hand, the Vietnamese borrow things from China without identifying it. They used to talk about deep plowing rice and things like this from the Chinese agricultural revolution, which Soviet Marxists would say is rubbish. And these things have been imported into Vietnam, but they're not identified as coming from China. The Vietnamese seem to be very interested in what the Chinese do medically in terms of combining Eastern and Western medicine. On the other hand, the Vietnamese have not yet, so far as I can tell, created barefoot doctors or anything like that, or talked about really taking these Chinese ideas. But they do have Eastern medicine hospitals, and 17, I think, in Vietnam at the moment. I have the feeling that they watch what's going on in China very carefully and do pick up things, but that they feel the Russian experience is a more stable one to learn from, given the fragility of their circumstances. And it's a hard question to answer. That's a very hard question to answer.
Yes.
Professor, could you comment on the present situation between Taipei and Peking?
Could I comment on the current situation between Taipei and Peking?
That's right.
I don't think I could. I'm sorry. I'm not sure what if there are things going on under the surface between Peking and Taipei. There may very well be. I don't know about it. Taiwan is an issue in the Chinese press and has been. One has the feeling that any day the Chinese leadership could say the Taiwan issue is more important to us than the border problems we have with the Soviet Union. One has the feeling that they're keeping both issues before the Chinese people, and they could, if they wanted to warm up relations with the Soviet Union for other reasons and play down the American connection, they could do it, because they do harp on Taiwan. They recently held a commemoration all over China of the anniversary of the what they call a massacre in Taiwan in the late 1940s, when the Kuomintang took over the island again after the Japanese had left it, and they played that up. But as to relations at the governmental level, secretly and so on, I have no idea. Okay.
There's one more then.
Right. Gentleman here.
Yes, your account of the two sides seems to assume that both of them have abandoned what I took to be a fundamental tenet of the Marxists, that you don't need to have anything like, anything analogous to the profit model to increase one's economic standards.
Mm-hmm.
The one side seems to say you have to have it, so let's do it. The other side says you have to have it, but let's not do it because we want to have equality. Is that a fair interpretation?
No. My discussion of it may have been very sloppy. The social egalitarians would say, no, you don't have to have it. They call this economism, Soviet economism, using the profit motive and so on. And
so they believe they can have economic progress without.
Without, that's right. As for the other side, that is the economic maximizers, as I've called them, I haven't seen any discussions of their attitude towards the profit motive question. It'll be very interesting to see what they do say about it, but I have not seen really basic discussions about it very recently. So all I can say is that the other side, the social egalitarians, don't believe that. So that I sort of gave the wrong suggestion. If I suggested that the social egalitarians felt that you needed a profit motive, they don't. They condemn that as jing-ji-ju-i, economism.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I don't think we can make the lecture period as long as the lecture was itself. We're getting pretty close to that now, so I think I'll have to ask that the questions be terminated now. I'll ask Dr. Prang if she'd be good enough to express our thanks to the speaker.
It's a great pleasure to me to thank on your behalf my distinguished colleague, Alec Woodside, for sharing with us this evening his very impressive understanding of a part of the world, both past and present, that is almost entirely closed to most of us. Despite the lateness of the hour and the fact that maybe Dr. Woodside won't entirely appreciate it, I'd like to tell a very brief story. 3 years ago this month, a recent graduate of Harvard published an article in the Harvard Crimson in which he reflected on his 4 years as a Harvard undergraduate during the height of the war in Vietnam. He was very critical of Harvard in those years, and he didn't like a great deal of what he saw and heard. He thought that on the whole, Harvard had betrayed its commitment to the values for which a university should stand. But he often felt that he shouldn't be there. He should be out trying to stop the planes from going to Vietnam or doing something dramatic to improve the world. But he stayed. And the reason that he stayed was that he could see around a few students and faculty who had not betrayed the values for which he thought Harvard should stand. They were people who, as he said, serve truth and thereby fulfill their obligations to the world around them. One of the people who was preeminent in doing that in this young man's mind was a professor in the Department of History, Alec Woodside. I think all of us who've heard this lecture tonight will know why that young man wrote as he did. Harvard was very fortunate to have Professor Woodside in that time of troubles. We are very fortunate in this university and in Canada that now he's decided to come home, and I hope he's going to stay with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Please come back again next Saturday night to hear Dr. Mabel Colbeck talk about songs and ballads, the pulse of the people.